Okay. Well, how are you doing today? That was Joe Newman on trumpet with Wednesday's Blues, featuring some really great sidemen: Frank Wess on tenor sax, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Eddie Jones on bass, and Oliver Jackson on drums. This is from Newman's 1960 album, Jive at Five. I'm getting a little funny tickle in my throat, so pardon me while I sound a little fuzzy, but the show goes on. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and a program I hope you will find useful and full of information. Well, let's see where we start today. I'm going to start with the Home Secretary. It's pretty much like the Secretary of State of Britain, who is hopping mad. And she's hopping mad at the United States, Washington, and hopping mad at media outlets, most specifically CBS and NBC. And she's angry because they may have jeopardized the investigation into the Manchester bombing, which, as you know, occurred on Monday, killing 29 people and wounding in excess of 50 people, almost 60 people. And of course, they shared this information because that's how countries are working in matters of terrorism. Her people advised Washington about what was going on, keeping them abreast of what was going on. And then, without warning, sorry, I said 22 people killed, I should correct myself. And then, without warning, the name of the bomber was broadcast on CBS and NBC, which means that somebody from the original source, which was the White House, leaked the information, and the enthusiastic TV networks, wanting to be first, named the suspect. Well, that's not the way Britain works, she says. That's not the way they do their thing when they're investigating something, and there's so many aspects to this awful tragedy that they generally lay off identifying anyone because it would, give the suspect or suspects a heads up as to whether the authorities are onto them or not. But that did not matter to CBS. It did not matter to NBC. They named the suspect, and it caused all kinds of problems because with naming him, it meant that the search that they were conducting and still are conducting, people were in that group. They suspect this was not a single person operation, the bombing, that he had other people involved in this heinous act. And so by naming him, it gave whoever he might have had contact with information that they were on to them. So I could understand her furor over this. And, the media really needs to understand sometimes they have to cooperate in some circumstances and just not be so focused about being first to report a story. And of course, this indicates that the White House is just full of holes. And we see the relationship. This is one of the instances in which information is leaked. The media and the White House are working hand in glove all the time. So, the Home Secretary Amber Rudd is her name, is so angry, she called Washington, D.C. and gave them a what for yesterday. And she apparently also called the news organizations and apprised them of the, you know, by doing what they do, sometimes they could really hamper a very, very important investigation. And they need to just use their judgment. She says it's not that they shouldn't report his name, but just hold off. Just hold off like they should. And whoever leaked it from the White House should have asked them to hold off until they get the signal that it was okay. This is a major event. This is a huge event. 20 people dead, 22 people dead, I'm sorry, 59 injured. They're still trying to locate bodies that they believe might be missing. But they are onto what they believe is a network. They're onto a network that worked to support the bombing by the main individual. Okay, I could understand how important it might be in news organizations to be the first to say something, but this is really not right. So she really let him have it, and I don't blame her one single bit. Today is also a day to celebrate diplomacy. And I had quite a chuckle, actually, observing our president, Donald Trump, visiting with Pope Paul. Oh, my God. Where am I mixing things up? It is not Pope Paul. It is Pope Francis. Perhaps it's because Pope Paul was so popular. His name stuck in my head. But Donald Trump ended his Mideast all-purpose tour and is now beginning his European all-purpose tour. And the first person that he is meeting with is the head of the Catholic Church. So he's covered the Muslim part of this. In Saudi Arabia, he has covered the Jewish element of this by going to Israel. Now he's onto the Trinity, the Trinity being the Catholics. He's talking to the head of the Catholic Church today. But it was very interesting. You know, I'm fascinated by the world of diplomacy and how people say things without saying things. So here's Trump, the ruler of the world. And today he got a shellacking so smooth, so imperceptible almost. It would take him probably a month or two to realize that he got taught today. First of all, Pope Francis decides, well, I'm not really going to be scrambling my schedule because I have a set schedule. And at 9 o'clock, I meet with the faithful. On the nose, 9 o'clock. You can talk, we can talk anytime up until 9 a.m. But after that, you got to go. So there was the first indication that the Pope was sending very, very, I'm telling you, so smooth. He was saying, I am continuing my work. I am not here to be part of your spectacle. I'm not part of your spectacle. There was no great, fandangle at the airport, no great party to welcome the president. He was given the dignity of being welcomed by an honor guard of the Swiss Guard, which is basically the honor guard and the police, if you will, for the Vatican. And that's it. Nice to see you. Come on in. I think we can manage between 20 minutes and half an hour, but come on in. Nice to see you. It's really great to see you. And they went into the Pope's office, where there is a plain wooden desk with a couple of, you know, knickknacks on it. And there's a picture that was disseminated today showing Pope Francis on a very stately chair on one side of the table, and there's Donald Trump on the other side of the table. And the picture suggested the power arrangement. It was just so stark. It looked like Donald Trump was in the principal's office. I kid you not. So he's sitting on the other side, and the Pope is, he's relaxed and he's engaged. He's looking Trump straight in the eye. But Trump looks like a school kid who has done something wrong and has been called to the principal's office. It's the first thing that came to my mind. And therein, you have an affirmation of power without any words having to be said. And if the picture communicates that, you know it also communicates an adjustment in Trump's attitude. He's not flashy. He's not full of himself. He's like a very petulant schoolboy sitting opposite the Pope, trying to make the best of his half hour because the clock is ticking, tick tock, tick tock. What are we going to be talking about, Mr. President? Oh, by the way, that too is an interesting dimension of the photograph and of the whole visit. You should know that the Pope is not only the head of the Catholic Church, which is 1.2 billion strong, billion Catholics. He's the head of the church as well. So Trump is sitting there. Trump is being allowed to converse with somebody who has got him credentialed twice over. He's the head of the Catholic Church. He's the head of the Vatican, which is its own country. And he's being so majestic, so concerned, so quiet. And you get all of this information from a picture released by the Vatican, because somebody got it too. look at, this is the President of the United States, and he sits there very contrite, very much aware that he doesn't call the shots here. He's got half an hour, make the best of it, and then you're out. Goodbye, have a safe trip, and we'll pray for you. Dominus vobiscum, but get the hell out of here. But anyway, you know that there has been some bad blood, because when Donald Trump was talking about building this magnificent wall on the southern border of the United States with Mexico, the Pope was known to remark that anyone who talks about building walls instead of bridges is not a Christian. I mean, that was a blistering comment to make coming from a Pope. He didn't name Trump, but everybody understood that the remark was directed at Trump. So Trump was just suffering from the effects of this remark by the Pope, which might as well have been a sledgehammer. So now that he is there, across the table, facing the Pope, one would think the old brass Trump would have said, you know, you said that about me and I didn't like it. I didn't appreciate it. No, he didn't say that. He understood he was in the principal's office. You see, the Pope did not give Donald Trump any razzmatazz, any glowing, PR pictures where, you know, he's standing next to Donald Trump and being used the way he used the other leaders, you know, to be there with him, which would elevate his status and would make him loom large on the world stage. The Pope is having this meeting in his office during regular business hours. I loved it. I thought that was just so cool. And he gave him, the Pope gave Trump, as he was leaving, a memento. And the memento was a medallion with a hand-sculpted olive. And that too, I don't think Trump really understood what was going on there. Trump gave the Pope the first edition of Martin Luther King's words. And that was nice, because now the president is accomplishing a particular mission. And he is saying, here I present you the words of a man we all admire in the United States. And here they are, hand-bound, and I ask that you accept this from us, the people of the United States. And then the Pope, in return, gave him this medallion with a carved olive. And it was to symbolize that he, Trump, should dedicate his life to peace. See? Whack! Another slap. Very nice. Very nicely done. So, in the meantime, Donald Trump, after leaving this morning meeting with the Pope, is going on to meet with the leaders of the nation, and they will have talks about which we don't know, but that is what is scheduled. Now, why we pay attention, the leaders of Italy, I should say, the Pope is the leader of the Vatican, he has his own bank, he's got his own, he makes the rules, he's got a guard, a military guard. He's got what he needs. And he's head of 1.2 billion Catholics all over the world, 24% of the U.S. population is Catholic. So in so many ways, he comes to this morning meeting understood to be a head of state. And he has his hand also in the United States, which Donald Trump doesn't have. Donald Trump isn't Catholic. See, all these dynamics are in play. They never get articulated. You just have to observe. So today, compared to the lavish receptions and the big fuss being made over Donald Trump, and it was wonderful to see. But the relationship, if there is going to be one, this is what the Pope is saying, the relationship, if there is going to be one, would be my decision. You don't get to come in here and stage your show. the Pope is a very savvy man, very bright man, very low key about his brilliance, but he's brilliant and knowledgeable. And the way he handled this thing this morning was just masterful. I was cracking up, saying, oh, wow, another hint that Trump missed, another clue out the window. He was totally clueless as to what Pope Francis was transmitting nonstop for the half hour that they met. I like to see that. I really do. Well, as you know, Mr. Trump might be away, but lots and lots of troubles at home, which he will have lots of time to appreciate when he gets back. And notice was served yesterday that he absolutely will have a fight on his hands about his proposed 2018 budget. Everybody is howling about the budget. Nobody likes this budget, not even Republican stalwarts. And they're running for the hills because people are so angry with this budget that they're turning on their party, even. They're saying, we didn't elect you to do this. We didn't elect you to rip from under our feet the carpet of protection. You're cutting Medicare, you're tinkering with, not Medicare, you're cutting Medicaid, you're tinkering with Medicare, you're cutting education, you're just slice and dice, the Ron Popeil of budgets. That's what you have on your hands. Yes, you know, they've got to be arguments about it and debates and The proposed budget is definitely not going to be the final budget when it comes before Congress. But just the idea that Donald Trump would allow a budget, you know he didn't write this budget, but would allow such a budget, such a caustic and anti-human budget to be written, let alone to be presented for consideration, tells you where his mind is. He is fully owned by the establishment. No sane person with his own mind would allow this document to be public and to be offered as the proposed budget, his first full budget for 2018. Nobody would do that. So you know he's out of his mind to think that it would get unilateral support. The part that we're going to listen to and parse now is the healthcare aspect of the budget. Everybody is very upset about it. And they're not explaining quite why, which is why I want to introduce what one of the most cogent analyses on the issue that I've listened to since the budget has been presented. And this comes from Senator Al Franken, a Democrat from Minnesota, who details the healthcare scam, he calls it, that Donald Trump and the Republicans are running on the American people. The budget, as he analyzes it with respect to healthcare, is a total give back or just gift to the wealthiest people in the United States. But I want to share this because this is really good instruction. He has been attacking the Republicans, and especially Trump, on healthcare. And he takes this portion of the budget apart so that we get an idea of the thinking behind it. So I wanted to share this with you. Here is Senator Al Franken, Democrat from Minnesota.
Today to talk about the health care bill that the House of Representatives has passed and is currently being considered behind closed doors by my Republican colleagues. I travel around greater Minnesota all the time, and when the Republican health care plan first came out, I traveled to rural Minnesota to meet with rural hospitals, nursing home providers, and constituents to hear how this bill would impact their lives and communities. They are upset, and they are frankly scared. In Perham, Minnesota, I heard from a woman who was in tears, not knowing where her mother would go if the Republican plan passed and she lost her nursing home coverage. This woman and her husband work full-time, but together they cannot afford the round-the-clock care that her mother needs. Later, at a nursing home in Moorhead, that's in Minnesota, across the river from Fargo, I also heard from a resident, Chris Ann, who said that this new plan wasn't about taking care of people, but, quote, about, quote, survival of the fittest, end quote. The hospital and nursing home administrators I met said that the financial blow they'd receive would cause them to cut services and, in some cases, even to close their doors. What I heard and the real panic that I saw is a far cry from what President Trump promised this past January when he said, quote, we're going to have insurance for everybody, end quote. And he went on to say it would, quote, it would be, quote, much less expensive and much better, end quote. Versions of these promises keep coming from President Trump, from his cabinet, and from his allies in Congress. Coverage for more people at lower costs with better quality. Those things all sound great. Things that might help people like Chris Ann. But the fact is that the Republican bill does the exact opposite. It takes coverage away from people. It drives up costs. And it makes coverage worse. In other words, the GOP is selling its health care bill on false pretenses. Today, I'd like to explain how the Republican bill betrays each one of these three fundamental promises, and let's take them one by one. We can start with the number of people that will be covered. President Trump promised that everyone would have insurance. But an analysis of an earlier version of the health care bill, the first iteration of this, which is actually not as bad as this one, but an earlier version analysis of it conducted by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office found that compared to the current law, the House Republican plan would leave 24 million fewer people with health insurance by 2026. That means by 2026, nearly one in five Americans under the age of 65 would be uninsured, compared to just over one in 10 today. One particular way that the Republican bill cuts coverage is by gutting Medicaid, a program that covers more than 60% of all nursing home residents nationwide, covers kids with disabilities and benefits nearly 70 million Americans. The Republican bill ends the Medicaid expansion, fundamentally undermines the basic structure of the Medicaid program, and cuts the program's budget by as much as a quarter over 10 years, a more than $800 billion cut. An $800 billion cut. On May 7th, journalist Jake Tapper of CNN asked Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price whether the hundreds of billions in proposed cuts would result in millions of Americans not getting Medicaid. Secretary Price responded, and I quote, "Absolutely not." Well, that's absolutely false. And when I say that absolutely, I mean that literally. It doesn't take an expert to know that if you take funding away from this program, which provides health coverage for millions of Americans, that the program suffers. And the human beings who rely on Medicaid will suffer as well. Specifically, according to the Congressional Budget Office, 14 of those 24 million people who will lose coverage under the Republican bill would lose their health insurance because of cuts to Medicaid. Absolutely not, says the Secretary of HHS. It is bad enough to push a bill that would take away care from millions who need it. It's extra galling to be so fundamentally dishonest about it in the process. Look, the Affordable Care Act is far from perfect, and we've got problems that need to be fixed. But let's step back and review how far we've come because of the ACA. Since it came into effect, about 20 million Americans have gained health insurance coverage, producing the lowest uninsured rate in the history of this country. In Minnesota, the number of uninsured dropped by nearly half, with people in rural areas seeing the largest gain in coverage. And as a result, we have eliminated the gap in coverage between rural and urban Minnesotans. These coverage gains have increased access to vital health services, including access to treatment for mental illness and substance use disorders. But the Republican health plan throws all of these gains into jeopardy, which is particularly troubling given that the country is still in the midst of battling a devastating opioid and heroin epidemic. Researchers estimate that 2.8 million Americans with substance use disorders would lose some or all of their insurance coverage under the ACA repeal. Let's be clear. People will lose coverage as a result of the proposed Medicaid cuts. People will lose coverage because of the proposed insurance reforms. And tens of millions of people would be uninsured and without care under the Republican plan than under current law. Okay, let's move on to the second point. The assertion, repeated constantly by President Trump and many others, that their bill brings down costs. In his Rose Garden celebration after the Republican health care bill passed the House, not to sign it into law, but a sort of an unprecedented Rose Garden celebration after merely the House passed the bill, President Trump said, and I quote, "As far as I'm concerned, your premiums, they are going to start to come down," end quote. Well, Secretary Price was asked again by Jake Tapper if he stands by the president's statement. He responded, quote, "Absolutely," end quote. On an earlier day, Secretary Price actually said, quote, "Nobody will be worse off financially," end quote, under the Republican plan. This is just blatantly wrong. Republicans are actively sabotaging the individual market, needlessly driving up premiums in the short term. And in the long term, what they are doing will result in exorbitant premium hikes for older, sicker people, so much so that CBO estimates that some will eventually drop out of the market altogether. Now, let me explain. For years, Republicans have taken deliberate steps to sabotage the individual market. First, Senator Rubio rammed through a last-minute change to the 2015 spending bill that undercut the Risk Corridor program. The Risk Corridor program, which was modeled after a similar program in the Medicare Part D program, was included as part of the ACA to offset high costs incurred by insurers as they took on new enrollees in the early years of the ACA. Now, here's how it worked. The federal government would make payments to health plans that enrolled a group of people that were sicker than expected and had higher health care costs than the insurer predicted when it set its premiums. On the flip side, the federal government would receive payments from health plans that enrolled a group of people that were healthier than expected and needed less care. By limiting losses incurred by insurers, the Risk Corridor program was designed to help make premiums more affordable for individuals and families who bought coverage on the exchange. But Senator Rubio's provision undercut all of this. It severely curtailed the payments that could be made under the Risk Corridor program, which meant the premium soared and health insurers left the market. For example, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota lost about $220 million between 2014-2016 under the weakened Risk Corridor program, which the CEO told me in a meeting late last spring was a huge setback for the company. I was dismayed but not surprised when I heard shortly after our meeting that the company was leaving the individual market, which affected coverage for more than 100,000 Minnesotans and contributed to average premium increases of 36% to 67% in Minnesota's individual market in 2017. Insurers across the country face similar destabilizing costs, but that's not all. On top of that, for months, President Trump has been doing his part to sow uncertainty by repeatedly arguing that the individual market is in a death spiral. For example, on May 4th, in response to Aetna's exit from the individual market in Virginia in 2018, President Trump shouted on Twitter, quote, "death spiral!" exclamation point. This is similar to his post on March 13th in which he said, quote, "Obamacare is imploding, it's a disaster, and 2017 will be the worst year yet, by far!" exclamation point, end quote. But he's wrong. Even the CBO noted in one of its scores that barring any significant changes, the individual market would probably be stable in most areas. This confirms what other research has found, which is that this year markets were starting to stabilize, which led Standard & Poor's to issue a report last December predicting that 2017 could see, quote, continued improvement with more insurers getting close to break even or better, end quote. But this didn't faze President Trump or any of the Republicans. Instead, they seem to have used these reports as a guidebook on what changes are necessary to actually cause the individual market to collapse. For example, President Trump has been playing games with payments that are due to insurance companies that reduce out-of-pocket costs for working families. On numerous occasions, he's threatened to stop these payments altogether. But in practice, he's been holding these payments hostage on a month-to-month basis to push forward other insidious reforms. Just yesterday, his administration announced that it would seek another short-term delay in the House's lawsuit, which aims to stop these payments permanently. These games are driving up the premiums for families and rattling health insurance markets. And lastly, the administration has stopped enforcing the individual mandate. As a result, we are seeing enrollment in the individual market stall for the first time since 2010. And if this results in younger, healthier people dropping their coverage, we could see prices rise dramatically for those left behind. That's right. President Trump and the Republicans are actively attacking the insurance markets, causing premiums to go up. So if these markets falter and consumers suffer, it is because of what Republicans are doing right now and have been doing for years to undermine the individual market. Still, you will often hear Republicans talk about the need to reduce costs. They even claim that their proposed health care plan would lower premiums in the long run. For millions of Americans, it's not true, but the reason why it's untrue is slightly complicated. It goes to the CBO report for the Republican health plan. The March 13th CBO score says that average premiums for single people in the individual market would be 15 to 20% higher than under current law, than under the current ACA in the first 2 years of its implementation. But it does say that they would be roughly 10% lower in 2026 under the House bill than they would be under current law. At first blush, this sounds like prices coming down for people, right? That's certainly what Republican leadership wants you to think. That day, House Speaker Ryan stated, and I quote, "This report confirms that the American Health Care Act will lower premiums and improve access to quality, affordable care," unquote. And House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy got more specific. He said, quote, "After 10 years, premiums will be 10% lower than under Obamacare," end quote. But Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McCarthy are being deliberately misleading. One of the reasons that average costs go down is that the price for some people would go up so much that they couldn't afford any insurance at all. If the people facing the most expensive insurance simply drop out of the market, sure, average costs go down. Here's how this works. Under the Republican plan, insurers would be able to charge older enrollees five times more than younger ones, which would dramatically increase premiums for people age 50 to 64 years old, while decreasing premiums for younger people. Meanwhile, the tax credits that help older Americans afford their premiums would be drastically slashed. The result is that, especially for older people of modest means, coverage would become unaffordable, so they disappear from the market. If only younger, healthier people can buy insurance, average premiums go down, but you've actually made the system much worse and much more expensive for the people who really need it. But that's not all. The Republican plan would also allow states to waive crucial protections for patients with pre-existing conditions, which means that in those states, we could go back to something like the old days when insurance companies could charge people with pre-existing conditions much more, potentially as much as $25,000 more for their coverage, as estimated by the AARP. Republicans are quick to point out that their bill maintains the requirement that insurance companies have to offer plans to everyone, but it abandons the principle that the plans must be affordable. An unaffordable plan does you about as much good as no plan at all. If you're young, if you have no pre-existing condition, it might be true that your premiums will go down under the Republican plan. For millions of Americans, though, if the Republican bill passes, insurance costs are going to go up. For many people, they'll go up so high that they are out of reach. That brings me to the third claim the Republicans are peddling, that their plan will result in higher quality coverage. In fact, Republicans want to open the door to junk insurance. In defending the House Republican plan, Secretary Price recently stated that the plan, quote, allows, quote, for every single person to get the access to the kind of coverage they want, unquote. We've heard this before. This is a code for allowing insurers to offer garbage insurance plans that offer skimpy benefit packages and impose much higher deductibles and cost sharing on consumers. Under the Affordable Care Act, you cannot sell junk plans on the insurance exchanges. Plans have to cover the essential health benefits. This is key. Under the ACA, plans have to cover the essential health benefits. 10 key categories of benefits, like prescription drugs, maternity care, and mental health services. And on top of that, the law prohibits insurers from imposing annual or lifetime limits on these essential health benefits. The goal is to make sure that when people get sick or if they have a pre-existing condition, they don't go broke getting the care they need because of fine print in their health insurance plan. The Republican bill would allow states to eliminate these essential health benefits. Consumers would be left with plans that leave them up a creek if they actually get sick. And plans for people who are sick, the price of those plans will go sky high. Now, no one would call that better care, which is why Republicans aren't really being straight about it. What they call flexibility is actually just the removal of consumer protections. So to review, the Republican plan covers fewer people, costs too many people more, in many cases much, much more, and provides worse coverage. And it's being sold by misleading people on each of these points. Now, it is not as though there aren't ways to cover more people, reduce costs, and provide better coverage. You could do it. You could do a public option, for example. You could reduce prescription drug costs, an issue on which I recently introduced a comprehensive bill. You could improve coverage by increasing the number of health care providers in rural areas, as I proposed last year in my rural health bill. But the Republican plan does none of these things, which raises the question, what does it do? Why would anyone take the time to propose such a terrible bill? And the answer is this. It gives a giant tax cut to the wealthy. That is the real point of this bill. It's not a health care bill. It's a take health care away from people who need it and use the money to give a tax break to the rich bill. As Chris Ann said in Moorhead, Minnesota, it's about survival of the fittest. The average tax savings for the 400 richest Americans under the Republican plan, $7 million each. $7 million each for households earning $1 million or more a year. It's more than $50,000 apiece each year. But for households earning $50,000 a year, which is about the median income in the United States, well, the tax cut is next to nothing, or you could even face a tax increase. There are tax cuts specifically for insurance company CEOs. There are tax cuts specifically for drug companies. There is nothing comparable for the middle class. And all of those tax cuts are paid for by cutting health care programs that keep people alive, by cutting off funding that lets seniors age with dignity, by cutting services for kids with disabilities. This bill would take us back in time and roll back our progress. It is up to us here in the Senate to stop that from happening. This bill is literally sickening. It is vicious. It is cruel. And it should never be passed into law. I urge my Republican colleagues to walk away from this cruel effort and work with us to actually improve health care for Americans. And I urge everyone considering this bill to be straight with the American people about exactly what it is that this bill will do to them. Thank you, Mr. President, and I would suggest the absence of a quorum.
All right. Well, that certainly gives us an entirely different view of the health care bill. Senator Al Franken from Minnesota. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.